This is the 343 Podcast. I'm your host, John Pronich. Welcome to the show. Technical debt is a concept in software development that reflects the implied cost of an additional rework caused by choosing an easy solution now instead of using a better approach that would take longer. If you choose, you can read the full Wikipedia entry on technical debt, which I've linked to in the write-up of this podcast. But in short, the longer you postpone doing things correctly, the greater debt you accrue, significantly increasing the risk of mild to catastrophic failures in your ultimate objectives. And the cost and effort to correct the problem and pay the debt increases the longer it persists, akin to accruing interest. How does this relate to individual player development and soccer, though? Well, a remarkably similar thing happens when a player is behind in their football development compared to their comparable age group, not just locally or regionally, but globally. So, in this episode, Gary Kleiben and I discussed technical debt, how far behind American players generally are, and if we can possibly catch up to the best players and nations in the world. We'll get started with this discussion right after a message about our online coaching education program. And as always, thank you so much for being here with us. When it comes to coaching education, being able to discern what will and won't help you can be costly and confusing. The internet is flooded with so much information. There are tons of drills out there for you to watch and tons of things that you can try with your players and teams. But without the proper context and the proper guidance from a legit mentor, you are not going to get the edge that you are looking for or the results that you want. That's what the 343 Premium Coaching Education Program gets right. It's rooted in the real experiences of a master practitioner that has coached soccer right here in America. As a coach, Brian Kleiben has been able to overcome all of the obstacles and produce college-level, professional, and international-caliber players. Training just twice per week, field congestion, pay-to-play, you name it. But using the 343 framework and staying consistent with the methodology has led to tremendous success. What the 343 coaching program offers you is a look at Brian's actual work, his real art. It's all captured and delivered to you in its purest form to help you gain an advantage and become a better coach. This exclusive online program features videos of Brian mic'd up during actual training sessions with his real players and teams as they prepare for league games and tournaments. This is the only program in the country that gives you this type of authentic, behind-the-curtain look at player, team, and coach development. It's unlike anything else in this country. It cannot be replicated, and it's not theory or speculation like you'd see in a presentation or something staged like you'd get at a convention. So if you're looking for drills, we've got those, but more importantly, we have the mentorship, the proven results, and the community of ambitious coaches that you won't find anywhere else. To experience all of this, consider joining the 343 Premium Coaching Education Program. You can find all of the details at 343coaching.com. All right, so today the topic is something that's actually, you know, brand new to me. I don't know how many people are going to be familiar with this term or the topic, but what you've been writing about is something called technical debt and your personal experience with it and then how that relates to soccer as well. And I just want to give you the opportunity to kind of just introduce the topic to everybody, and then we'll kind of just pick that apart and see what we get into.
Yeah. The origin of the term technical has nothing to do with soccer. It doesn't mean technique in soccer. It simply originates, I think, from software development and computer programming. And that's how I first came across it in graduate school. You know, there's a lot of programming that I had to do to mathematically model certain physical systems. That's when I really had to develop a program that was of significant length. I don't know what it was. Maybe it was a couple thousand lines of code. I really don't remember. But when a program starts getting that lengthy, you start running into trouble. Because one, if there's a bug, then it starts becoming more difficult to debug the code and see where your error is. And two, you know, if you want to then add certain functionality to your code in order for it to be able to handle certain edge cases or different types of scenarios, then it becomes more complicated as well. Because if you have one program that is several thousand lines, then that additional functionality, that additional code that you're going to put in there could break other things. And you might have interoperability issues and a whole slew of problems start creeping up to you. That's if you're doing something that is not well designed from a software development standpoint. So I studied. I went into computer science books, all the resources available to me. And the more and more I learned, the more and more you realize that best practice for application development or programming is something called modular design, instead of what I was doing, which was just writing one huge chunk of code. And what modular design means is instead of one big chunk of code, maybe you write 10 different pieces of code, each one specifically designed to do just one task. And then those 10 different pieces of code, which are called modules or objects, if we want to talk about object-oriented programming, get stitched together in the code base. So if something breaks, then all you can easily target where it broke in one of those 10 modules. And since those modules are small and compact, it's easy to debug. So that kind of fixes the debugging issue. And then if you want to add functionality to the entire code base, you don't have to be as careful, because you can maybe just create another module, you know, another little compact function that increases the functionality of your overall program. So in the process of learning, you know, good practices in software development, you've come across this term called technical debt, whereby if you were dumb like me and you didn't do a modular architecture from the get-go, then when you want to refactor or redesign your code to make it modular, you have to write everything all over from scratch, okay? So in essence, you've accrued this debt that you have to pay in order to get on a much better footing and moving the program forward. And that was just me with a silly little 2,000 or 3,000 line code program. I don't want to venture into, you know, my first startup company, which failed, which was an electronic medical records, but this was a web-based application, which was way bigger than a few thousand lines of code. But then technical debt really hit me in the face, because the program got so large that these issues that I just described were really amplified to a degree where it was extremely frustrating that we couldn't get our code base to function in a well-streamlined manner. So all of this to say that if you're doing things incorrectly for an extended period of time, you're accruing a debt there that at some point down the road, you're going to have to pay back, and it's going to be extremely painful to pay back. And you may end up failing altogether, not being able to pay back if you wait too long. I'll pause there, John, because that's kind of like the long-winded explanation of the origin of technical debt.
Yeah, and I think that last little bit really sets up the transition into how this applies to player development, soccer development, and can really kind of just start the conversation about, you know, if a player is doing things right from the time that they are 8, 9, 10 years old, well, they have an incredible head start over the players that aren't. But it also kind of opens the door to the conversation of, you know, what happens if players don't realize that they are, or they had been accruing this technical debt until they were 15, 16, 17. Are these players now, you know, lost cause? I think I've talked about or asked that question in a separate episode. But yeah, it kind of just transitions nicely into how does this apply to soccer?
Yeah, we always hear the phrase or the question thrown out there in the soccer world, hey, if a player is 18, 19, 20 years old, they always say that, oh, the player is very young, super young. They can improve so much more. Their ceiling is still incredible, and they can reach the highest levels of the game. And, you know, I kind of squirm at that because in general, that's not true. If the player up until the age of 18, 19, 20 has accrued all this technical debt, if they have not been properly trained or properly taught how to properly receive a ball and stroke a pass and in a variety of different contexts and scenarios, and that's on the technique side. And then there's the whole soccer IQ side and the mentality side that we can dive into. But if up until the age of 18, 19, they haven't done it as well as their international counterparts, let's take somebody that everybody understands, maybe like a Xavi or Iniesta or Busquets, because of, obviously I'm a Barcelona fan. Those players have been born and bred in an academy that teaches technique to the highest degree from an early age. And so if you're here in the States and you're not in an environment that's doing the same sort of teaching, then an 18-year-old from Barcelona compared to an 18-year-old here in the United States, there's going to be a huge gap on the technique side of the equation. So the American has a huge technical debt to pay back in order for them to catch up to their international counterpart, which is practically impossible, man, because you're 5, 6, 7, 10 years behind on the curve. And, you know, you can work as hard as you like on those sorts of things, but your international counterpart continues to work on their craft while you try to catch up. And so they're perpetually ahead of you. So this technical debt, in my opinion, can't be paid back. And your ceiling as a player is much lower than that counterpart I just described.
One of the things I was looking up as you were talking, just to kind of compare players and compare their journeys, was the age of Kubo, so the Japanese player that grew up in the Barcelona system. He made the big move to Real Madrid, I think at 17 or 18 years old, and now he's playing with a different club in La Liga. But, you know, at 19 years old, this player is, you know, pretty remarkable, and he has been working in a proper system for his entire youth career, and he will continue to develop his skills. He will continue to get better and better and better. And then I started to try to think about like an American example around the same age, and Paxton always comes to mind. And so it's like, okay, so if this player Kubo and Paxton are on, you know, they're around the same age, and people are thinking that Paxton is young and he can still develop, it's like, okay, well, yeah, his counterparts, his global counterparts, are not done developing either. And they have massive head starts over him. So, you know, who has a higher ceiling? You know, probably the global counterparts. I don't know if that's something that you were, you know, trying to get at, or if something that makes sense.
No, of course. And that is accurate. Kubo got, you know, loaned out to Mallorca, and he was the starter and played a whole bunch of minutes at Mallorca and performed incredibly well. He played against Barcelona, where he grew up, and he sliced and diced Barcelona when they played each other. So that player's trajectory is on a rocket to the moon. Yeah, and Paxton, you know, as good as he is, and I'm sure he's going to have a good long career as a professional soccer player, he's just so far behind the eight ball. And he's older, by the way. He's 20, going to be turning 21 in December. His technique will never be what Kubo's is. His soccer IQ will never be what Kubo's is. And then there's the mentality and the physical components, which are interesting discussions in and of themselves with regards to technical debt. Take the mentality side of the equation. If you've been born and bred for this professional path, again, since you were 10 in a professional type environment, like an FC Barcelona, like one of those great academies overseas, and your environment there and the household and everything is to the point where you are developing a professional soccer player, well, the mentality side of the equation might be getting well developed also. It's not a guarantee, but it might be getting developed in a very good way versus the American counterpart in our soft environment, as I called it, for 10 years here in the States, may not necessarily be getting the same sort of development on that front. So when you make the leap, maybe to the higher levels in Europe, there's an adjustment there that you may or may not be well equipped to do. So there's a mentality debt that can occur. To maybe give a specific example, or a more specific example on the mentality debt, if you have the right habits, the right training habits, the right lifestyle habits, things of that nature, since you're a young pup, then that is who you will probably be as a 18, 20, 25, 30-year-old professional. You'll have the right habits, the right lifestyle that is aligned with your continual improvement and success as a professional. And here in the States, well, I don't know. I don't know if the right habits are inculcated and the right mentality, the right lifestyle is incorporated into the player. So that would also be a debt there, John.
On that note, it brings up two thoughts. So one, like you're talking about now, where the player kind of has to take responsibility and develop those habits themselves in order to kind of set themselves up for success. And then, you know, how do they understand that process, I guess, is the first thought. And then the second thought is the system here, or is, you know, is the American soccer environment set up in a way in order to help these players, you know, achieve success as well? And you mentioned, you know, Europe and the differences that they have there. And I'm looking at a bullet point right now on the Wikipedia page for the topic of technical debt. And there's one interesting bullet point. There's a bunch, but there's one that stands out, and it says lack of process understanding, where businesses, or in this case, soccer players or the soccer environment here, are blind to the concept of technical debt and make decisions without considering the implications. So that to me kind of is talking about, like, you know, if a player is not creating good habits, or if a team is not really sure about what the development process is, because, you know, a lot of teams here, a lot of clubs here are just youth clubs. So, you know, what is the understanding of the process of what goes into making a true, you know, professional player is probably misunderstood here at large or in general. So yeah, that the lack of process or understanding, I think, is a big component to why the American soccer players is typically behind their global counterparts.
No question. I don't have much to add to that. I think you said it quite well, and I agree with it. Every touch point along a young player's path is important, and I'm not sure if we understand the process here in the States at scale. What I would add is, you mentioned this is applicable to youth clubs. I would say it's also applicable to the MLS clubs and every operation here in the States. People may be familiar that U.S. Soccer /MLS years back, you know, hired this consulting firm called Double Pass to come and assess the academies, the environment of the development academy. Those results were never made public. Those results of that study were never made public, you know, but my sources tell me that, you know, it wasn't a pretty picture. You know, we weren't really getting a passing grade on a variety of fronts. The one I think we did pass was infrastructure, which is quite interesting, because a lot of people yell, oh, Gary, you know, we're still young here as a soccer nation. We don't have the infrastructure that other nations have. And I always come back with saying, what are you talking about? We have the world-class infrastructure, world-class fields, world-class money, world-class every, you name it, on the infrastructure side, we have it, okay? What we don't have is, as you mentioned, John, process, the development process, what is being taught, how it's being taught, who is doing the teaching, and everything that goes into the formation of a footballer. That is what we don't have at scale. We have some good stuff in small little pockets, small little niches here and there across the country with good people doing good work. But, you know, I don't think that the whole package is being put together. But that's another discussion.
And as you mentioned that too, it's almost like we as a soccer nation have just accrued so much technical debt that it's hard for us to kind of to catch up to, you know, the Spains, the Brazils, the Hollands, and, you know, the longer that we kind of state the way that we are, just the more debt we accrue and the harder it is to pay off in the long run. And we keep coming up with all these initiatives and programs and ideas, you know, 10-year plans and whatnot. But if we don't change anything, there's really going to be no progress made in paying off that, you know, technical debt as a soccer nation.
Yeah, we have to start from scratch. And the problem is, you know, to get it right, you have to hire the right people in the right positions and organize your organization the right way. And then you're starting from ground zero because these people need time to now work. And so we're perpetually, John, on this mouse wheel, this 5-10 year plan that never goes anywhere, you know, because we're not hiring the right people. We're not doing the things that we need to do. We're just launching new initiatives and then saying, okay, now the clock starts. 10 years from now, you see the fruits of our labor. It never comes.
And what's kind of interesting, though, is that, you know, over the course of 10 years, a lot can happen, but we've just continued to do pretty much the same thing. You know, every time that we launch a new initiative, it's just the same people doing pretty much the same thing, just dressing it up a little bit differently. So that's why we probably haven't seen much change, but tons of change can be made in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years. And so this, you know, this notion that, you know, we can't someday become, you know, a contender or a, even a global superpower, I think is misguided. Because if you started doing the right things with 9 and 10 year olds right now, by the time these players are 20 or 25, 10, 15 years from now, you know, they're competing against other kids that were 9 and 10 at their same age and, you know, are on the same playing field. So, you know, just the longer that we delay that change or that process, I think it just keeps us in, like you said, that mouse wheel.
Yeah. And those isolated pockets of good people doing good work, they usually end up producing something. If you want to talk about the Pulisics, the Tyler Adams, you know, our boys and Richie Ledesma, Soto, and this whole generation that has now moved to Europe at a very young age, you know, they obviously came from somewhere that enabled them to at least reach the level where they have interest overseas to the point where they have a shot now. And then as a nation as a whole, you know, with this batch of players in Europe now getting, you know, good training and being placed in a good environment for development purposes, those things might bear fruit now by 2026. Because, you know, what is that, 6 years from now? So those guys will be kind of like in the prime of their professional careers. And contrast that to generations past, where Americans wouldn't necessarily be jumping over to the best environments in the world at such an early age, and certainly not in the numbers that have just occurred. They might go later. I don't know when Clint Dempsey went over, or players like that, the handful of players that went over, but I don't think it was at age 17. I think it was later in their careers. And that makes a difference because there's that debt again, right? If you jump overseas at the age of 23 instead of 17, then there's a 6-year gap that occurred there. I'm not saying that's exactly what happened. I'm trying to transmit this notion again of technical debt so that people can maybe apply it in different situations, even though it might be an incorrect application of the concept, at least the concept is in their mind.
Yeah, I'm trying to think about the guys that, you know, after the 2010 World Cup or 2006 World Cup, you know, we had a couple players that left and went to Europe, but they were, you know, they were in their mid-20s at that point. They weren't teenagers. And, you know, there's a big difference between Christian going to Borussia Dortmund at 16 versus Josie Altidore going to Holland, you know, 22, 23. So there's quite a significant gap there. And actually, I had written down a question about Christian Pulisic and the importance of the timing of when he went over to Borussia Dortmund. So, and it really came from the fact that Americans are at a bit of a disadvantage, especially those that are true Americans, where meaning that they don't have the ability to go to Europe on a whim like Christian did with his Croatian passport. So you know, if a player wants to leave the American environment, they have to wait until they're 18 in most cases. Christian had the opportunity to leave when he was 16. And I wanted to kind of get your thoughts on how that may have been an advantage for him over, you know, some of his American peers that had to stick it out in this environment for two extra years.
Yeah, there's no question. You also see it with Giovanni Reyna now too at Dortmund. If you're able to go at 16, then you have those two additional years to acclimatize to the club and for the club to really get to know you better as a footballer in every facet. And then that adjustment period, you know, facilitates you taking the next step, you know, to the first team, as you saw what happened with both those players. On the Giovanni front, in my opinion, there are additional factors for his jump to the first team so quickly. Whether they're real or not, I don't know. But one in particular, you know, we should probably consider is on the business side of things. You know, that particular club had such a great experience with Christian and what it meant for the business of the club and the eventual transfer of Christian for such big money that, you know, now you have that taste and you want to repeat it. And I think, you know, their investment in Gio from the get-go in large part is more facilitated, you know, from that experience. And then propelling Gio to the first team, you know, is facilitated even more. But we're not talking about the business side necessarily. We're talking about that two additional years of being in a great environment. So if there are gaps in a player's game, they can, you know, they can start paying that debt back sooner rather than later. But the other side of that story, their flip side, is usually what happens at a club, if they're going to get a foreigner, that foreigner has to be better than what they currently have in their setup. They don't get a foreigner just because, oh, it looks like he's at the level or good enough, you know, not to stick out like a sore thumb here. No, you have to be better than what they already have. So in that regard, this technical debt notion is a little bit bunk, because that means that they saw Christian, they thought Christian was better than all their academy players or a great proportion thereof. Same with Gio and same with Richie Ledesma, say with Sebastian Soto, Chris Gloucester, Alex Mendez, Uli Giannis, Kobe Foster, Josh Sargent, you name all the guys that made that exodus, it means that those guys were better than what those clubs already had. But again, John, these are exceptions, okay? The general rule is not that.
It kind of makes me think about one of Brian's most recent episodes where he talked a lot about Christian and how Christian is surrounded by other players that are at or above his level when he's playing with Chelsea, and how that transition back to the U.S. men's national team, where he's surrounded by a player like Jordan Morris or Christian Roldan or a Michael Bradley, and how that's different because now he's playing with, you know, players that are below his level and you know, players that would have never been able to crack a team like Borussia Dortmund at age 17. They would never been able to crack a roster like Chelsea at age 21, 22, 23. And these are the types of players, Jordan Morris, for example, when we're talking about technical debt, you know, he has so much technical debt that he's never going to be able to pay off any of that to even, you know, get close to Christian's level. And then that's who we expect Christian to partner with and to take us forward into the future, which I maybe that thinking about it in this way will illustrate it differently for people, and maybe they'll start to think about like, oh yeah, like Christian and Jordan, that's completely lopsided now when I think about it like that. I don't know if people can think about it like that.
Yeah. No, and this debt again is the reason why we need our national team players to be playing at the highest levels of the game. Because if they're in subpar levels, and yeah, forgive me, but MLS is quite subpar to playing in Europe. If our national team players are coming from this environment, they're just not, it's just not good enough. It's just not good enough for the international level. You are every day in this environment, you are losing ground to the international counterparts who are every day in the European high caliber environment. So for us to be successful 2022, 2026, and be respectable and things of that nature and beyond, we need our national team players to be playing at the highest levels. Full stop, end of story. And this is something that is not new, I don't think, but people need to understand it because I see a lot of hype surrounding about we should have all these MLS players on the national team because they look good and they're performing well here in MLS, and it's just misguided. And Jurgen, you know, was, I think, one of the, if not the only, national team coach in our history who really made this point in the public sphere. We need our players playing overseas. And I think allegedly he would always try to facilitate or make that bridge so that players would go overseas instead of being here. And he would critique when our players like Bradley and Dempsey came back from Europe and Altidore came back from Europe to play in MLS, you know, because that makes his job as the national team coach that much harder, because now some of his centerpieces or important pieces to his puzzle, his team, national team puzzle, are in a lower environment, surrounded by players of lower caliber. So anyways, I don't know where else to go from there aside from making the point that these things matter.
Yeah, they matter. And I think context matters too. And people maybe forget the context of, you know, where MLS really is in comparison to, you know, the top five leagues in the world. And I'll just kind of, you know, throw this last thing out there and see if you have any thoughts about it. But, you know, Christian, one of the last games of the 2020 Premier League season, you know, carved up the Liverpool defense, you know, where these guys are getting paid, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in transfer fees or, you know, whatever. They're Champions League winners, you know, Premier League top defenders. So Christian is dicing up players like that in a, you know, fairly large or fairly big stage. And then people see somebody like a Brendan Aaronson do that in Major League Soccer, and they think it's comparable. They think it's like the same thing. They think that's on the same level. And another example would be Paxton. Paxton can, you know, dribble through a couple of defenders in Major League Soccer, and people think it's something remarkable. But when you take Paxton's performance at the U20 World Cup, Paxton didn't dribble past anybody. He didn't create any chances for himself. He didn't really create any chances for his teammates. And, you know, because the competition, even at the U20 level, in my opinion, was significantly higher than what he was facing in Major League Soccer, even at, you know, 19 years old. He's able to do more things against these kind of, you know, these MLS level defenders, which these are guys that are getting paid peanuts and being courted by absolutely nobody on the global stage except for these Major League Soccer teams. So there's just a ton of context that people, I think, need to think about when they see a player like Brendan Aaronson or Jackson Yule or these guys that are in MLS, when you see them do something quote unquote remarkable against, you know, MLS teams. It's much different when Christian does it against, you know, his opponents, whether you're talking about Liverpool or somebody that's mid-table or even bottom of the table in the Premier League or in the Champions League next season. So
I think, to be fair, they know that the Premier League's higher level, right? And I think they know that there's a difference there. I think what might not be appreciated is the size of the gap, maybe. But, you know, I think going back to what I said about the future of the national team, you know, and its performance 2022, 2026 and beyond hinges on our players being in Europe and developing in the best environments. I think what that will prompt, well, actually what will prompt MLS to act a certain way is this exodus of players that I rattled off earlier to Europe. The league, if it wants to kind of take some credit for the success of the national team in these future World Cups and competitions, what the league is now forced to do, it's forced to be a selling league. It's forced to now accept transfers when offers come in for players like Paxton or Brendan Aaronson or Mark McKenzie, etc. Because if they don't transfer these players to Europe, what will end up happening is if you're the national team coach, if you're Greg Berhalter, you are going to pick the best players and you are going to end up picking this from this European large European contingent that we have. You won't be necessarily picking MLS players. You're not going to put your performance as a coach on the international stage on the line by picking MLS players for your World Cup roster. And with that well understood, MLS is going, and for MLS to gain some credit, they're going to have to transfer these players to Europe and then, you know, have Greg or whoever's national team coach be able to pick those sorts of players. And then MLS will be able to say, well, they were born and bred in MLS. You know what I'm saying? Developed in MLS versus what ended up happening with this current generation. Most all of them did not sign deals with MLS or the USL affiliates, and they left from the beginning. So claiming credit is going to be a little bit more difficult. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something I think we talked about in another episode, you know, claiming credit, who can claim credit. And in the American environment, credit seems to be oddly something that people seek, which is really weird. But I think we talked about it in a way that, you know, because there is no other mechanism of reward other than credit outside of Major League Soccer, who now accepts those transfer fees and solidarity payments and whatnot. But, you know, the other environments in America, they really just kind of thrive off credit. It's their only way. So,
yeah. So anyways, bringing this all maybe home to young players here in the States and their families, you know, and their goals and dreams and ambitions. Think about this technical debt that we just described and think about how to not accrue so much debt from an early age. And that's a matter of, you know, putting in long hours, putting in a lot of work and seeking out practitioners and helpers and mentors that are good at what they do in this regard so that your player can take advantage. And maybe your player's competition is the one that has the debt and it's not your player that's, you know, in a hole.
Our flagship program helps coaches and trainers discern what is good for their teams and for their players. But now we've created a program for parents. Because parents, you are personal trainers too. Yep, that's right. And in order to properly mentor your player, you need to know what's good and what's not. Just like coaches, you and your player are flooded with thousands of training videos on YouTube and Instagram. But most of them are a waste of time because they aren't relevant. They don't translate to the real game. And figuring out what does and what doesn't and why is just flat out difficult, especially if you don't have a background in soccer to lean on. So we've taken Brian Kleiben's more than 20 years of experience working with teams and individual players from U9 to U19 and extracted valuable lessons that can help you navigate the minefield that is American youth soccer. But this isn't just about drills. That's only a small fraction of it. And to be honest, you can get drills anywhere. What you're getting with the 343 Masterclass are the cultural lessons and an education in philosophy that other trainers and courses don't offer. It's these elements that can help you understand the landscape, read the game on and off the field, and translate everything into real development for your player. Right now, you can get on the list for the 343 Masterclass. We are currently rolling it out little by little to small groups. To reserve your spot, go to 343masterclass.com. All right. Thank you for listening. Do you have a question about the topic that we covered in this episode? If so, we'd love to hear from you, and we will be answering some of your questions at the end of next week's episode. Submit your questions on Twitter or head to 343coaching.com to leave your question in the comment section. Make sure that you are subscribed to 343 FM on your favorite podcasting app. The show is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, and many more platforms. And if you're feeling super generous, we'd love it if you dropped us a 5-star rating or a review. And don't forget that you can find our entire library of podcast episodes, over 200 written articles, and our online courses that help accelerate the development of coaches and players using methods that have been proven to work here in the United States. Once again, all of that can be found at 343coaching.com. All right. Thank you so much for listening. We will catch you next time here on the 343 Podcast.